From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. We grow up reading stories about little girls who fall down magic rabbit holes and boys who outsmart giants. Then we grow up and discover that in the real world there are no pots of gold or magic satchels, just 401ks and 30-year mortgages. But just because we don't believe in fairy tales or magic doesn't mean we don't still need them.
Fairy stories are, in a sense, the opposite of religion. You don't believe them. You know you don't believe them. They're there in order not to be believed, and yet you need them.
We tend to say, this is just my imagination. But actually, our imaginations are the only doorway that we have to other possibly invisible worlds around us.
It's like when people say, well, is there magic? Do you believe in magic? What is magic? And I'm sort of saying, well, magic's a way of seeing the world. Magic's everywhere. You just have to look at things properly.
In this hour, writers Neil Gaiman, A.S. Byatt, and Salman Rushdie explore the uses of enchantment, why stories about fairies and wizards and elephant gods and magical underground kingdoms have something important to say. So come along for a magical ride.
I've always wanted to have a flying carpet in a novel, and I finally made it. If you have not yet flown on a magic carpet, you probably don't know about the seasickness. A flying carpet makes a slow, rolling, wave-like movement as it passes through the air. Not exactly as if it's floating on air waves, but more as if the carpet itself has become a kind of silken air that can bear you aloft and take you wherever you want to go. It's sad but true that your stomach may find this kind of travel disagreeable, at least for a while.
Salman Rushdie, reading from his new novel, Luca and the Fire of Life. We'll talk with him a little later this hour. First, a story about just how far some people will go to get a little magic back in their lives. Sidney Pike was working 10-hour days for a New York publishing house when she chucked it all to go looking for fairies in Mexico and the British Isles. She tells the story of her adventure in a new memoir called Fairy Tale. Anne Strangehams asked,
what on earth made you want to set out to find fairies?
Well, that's a great question, and it was a question I was asking myself continually on my journey. My father had passed away when I was 26 years old. It was an unexpected death, and I found that I was just not able to really get over it. I went to work every day, and I came home and went to bed and sort of did it all over again the next day. In the meantime, there was this woman who lived in my building. Her name was Raven Keyes, and she was one of my neighbors. And she was over for wine one night, and she said to me, do you know, she said, the fairies absolutely love your apartment. It is just filled with fairy energy. And I looked at her, and I said, I think she's had one too many. But I started to ask her, well, what do you mean? And she said, well, you know, I believe that there are fairy energies, they're connected to the earth, and they're even here in Manhattan. And I found that, you know, of course, I didn't believe her. But at the same time, I found that I was really moved by her sense of belief. And it planted a seed, and I started thinking about why I had stopped believing in magical things. Why did I stop believing in the fairies I believed in as a little girl?
So at the heart of your quest, if you want to call it that, was, yes, you were looking for fairies, but you were looking for something more. You were trying to get back to a sense that the world we live in is a magical place, that there's something enchanted about it.
Yes, exactly. You know, I was listening to the news every day, and it was war and destruction. And I just thought, you know, I don't know about you guys, but this isn't really the happily ever after I was hoping for. I wanted to find a sense of belief in possibility. And so really, at its heart, Fairy Tale is the story of my quest to believe.
So you set out to see if you could find the fairies yourself. The first place you went is not the first place most people would think of looking for fairies. You went to Cancun in Mexico. What were you looking for?
Well, when I went to Mexico, I went with my friend Raven. She's a bit of a New York City spiritual guru, and she was taking a group of women for yoga and meditation in Tulum, Mexico. Before I left, I was poking around on the internet online, and I saw that there was this type of fairy that lived in Mexico called Los Alushas, and it made me think, if I can find that there's still some folklore alive about trolls or fairies in Mexico, then couldn't I find it anywhere? So that's really what happened. I was surprised at everything that unfolded there.
You found people who believe in Los Aluxes?
Yeah, it was wild. You know, at first I was this pasty white tourist and I felt so embarrassed to go into a bar. But the hostess of our inn where we were staying told me to go to this place where she said that everybody believed in Los Aluxes and in fact that they were seen there all the time by the workers at the hotel. So I went down there with a buddy of mine for lunch and was kind of playing undercover fairy detective. I had a couple beers and got talking to the bartender. And as soon as I asked him, do you know, have you heard or seen anything about Los Aluxes? His jaw dropped and he said, you've heard about them? And he began to tell me stories of all of the locals who had had run-ins with these little creatures.
What kinds of stories did people tell about them? What sort of encounters had they had?
Well, you know, this was an interesting first dip into the fairy world because a lot of the folklore talks about how fairies are dangerous. And of course, we have this very light and airy pixie dust image of them. The stories I heard in Tulum were actually kind of frightening. The bartender told me that he had a friend who was digging a garden and he dug up this stick and stone structure. They're like little scarecrows that the Mayans used to make. And he said, I'm going to keep this thing. This is amazing. And so he did everything he was supposed to. He gave it tributes every day, little food, little water. But he had this dog that he really loved. And the dog started having these little cuts all over it. But he couldn't understand because he was keeping this dog in and it wasn't going out and wandering the beach or the jungle at night. And according to this bartender, the man started to suspect that it was because this little Aluxe, as they call them, they're supposed to be very jealous. And that this Aluxe was very jealous that he loved his pet so much, and it was hurting his pet. So he got really angry, and he kicked the little wooden thing across the room, and he cursed at it. And the next morning when this man woke up, his dog was dead, hanging from the rafters of his hut. So I was thinking, what have I gotten myself into?
Well, did you personally have any creepy encounters with Los Aluxes or anything that seemed strange?
Well, the thing that happened to me happened before I met that bartender. I had been down at the Tulum ruins that day, and I went to bed that night, and I got up, and it was in the middle of the night, and I really had to use the restroom. And it was while I was in there that I got the strangest feeling, like the hair on the back of my neck rose, and I felt like I wasn't alone. And it's hard to explain, but I felt or saw a flash in my imagination of this very vivid, short, hairy, troll-like creature standing there looking at me. And it was so vivid. He had dark brown eyes. He had very tan, weathered skin. He had very long, shoulder-length, very matted, kind of dirty-looking brown hair. And he was just standing there with his jaw kind of set, just looking at me, and I was terrified. But of course, it was sort of in my mind. So I just said, you know, that's my imagination. I'm just imagining this. And I went back to bed, although I brought my lady's razor with me from the bathroom just in case.
You're gonna fight him off with your shick?
Yeah, exactly. I wouldn't go down without a fight. But the thing that was really kind of scary was that when I was talking to this bartender, he described to me what Los Aluxes look like when people see them. And he described them as looking exactly like the thing that I had or hadn't seen that night, the night before.
Hmm. Was there a moment when, you know, it was just one thing too many and you felt like, that's it, I believe?
You know, one of the most amazing moments that I had was when I was sitting in Glastonbury, England at night in this garden called the Chalice Well Garden, and I saw these very distinct tiny pinpricks of sparkling light of all different colors in the bushes zooming around, and it almost looked like they were city lights. But of course, Glastonbury is actually pretty rural.
Fireflies?
That was one thing that crossed my mind, but these were teeny pinpricks of light, and they moved so rapidly from left to right, zooming all over the place, blue, orange, red, white, all different colors. I even asked one of my entomologist friends if she knew of any insect in the United Kingdom that could make a light like that, and she said, you know, certainly in all her years at Cornell, she'd never heard of one.
What do you think they were?
I think in that moment, you know, I felt like I'm seeing the fairy realm. I don't know whether it was one being or their energy or what, but I definitely felt, I knew at that moment I was experiencing something that maybe I could never explain.
How has that experience stayed with you? How has it changed you?
You know, I guess I felt like when I started the journey, I was living in Manhattan, and I wasn't very awake to my life. I was sort of sleeping through my days, metaphorically speaking. And I felt like when I left on my journey, I really came awake. I had thought that you had to travel far away in order to find enchantment. And what I actually realized is that if you learn how to open up your eyes and be aware of the world around you, and you get in touch with your world around you, especially with the earth, which we're all very connected to as people, and we sometimes forget that, that now I can see magic in my own backyard. I do believe it's very possible for us to access this type of enchantment, and that's my mission now, is to sort of help other people who are interested in reviving their sense of wonder to do so, to learn how to do so.
How does one learn how to do that?
One thing to do is to be open to it and to just be easy on yourself. You know, we tend to say, this is just my imagination. But actually, our imaginations are the only access, the only doorway that we have to other possibly invisible worlds around us. So that's our tool. And I think getting in touch with the stories that moved us as little kids and trying to see what still resonates there is one thing. But other things that people can do to sort of come alive again is to take some time for themselves to just be still, sit, connect, whether it's meditation for 10 minutes in the morning before your kids wake up and you have to take them to school, to really just sit and breathe and remember, I'm a human being living on planet Earth. Everything in my body is composed of the earth around me, but also really learning to be present, you know, taking joy in small moments. Like I found on my trip that my experiences had changed me and made me want to relate more. I would look at people in the eye when I made a transaction at the grocery store and smile. These are the moments where you realize that you're awake in your daily life. And so that's the first step. And after that, if you're open to it, the magic, I believe, will find you.
Sydney Pike is the author of Fairy Tale, One Woman's Search for Enchantment in a Modern World. She talked with Anne Strange Champs. Next, writer Neil Gaiman joins us to celebrate the 10th anniversary of his cult classic American Gods, the story of a newly paroled prisoner who takes a road trip with an undercover Norse god. Think High Noon meets Armageddon. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for To the Best of Our Knowledge comes from the University of Wisconsin Online Bachelor of Science in Sustainable Management, developing leaders with the critical skills to grow a green economy. Information is at sustain.wisconsin.edu.
Neil Gaiman is among the most celebrated writers of the fantastic. He's the author of the Sandman comic book series, the award-winning children's novels Coraline and The Graveyard Book, and several novels, including one that's considered a modern classic, American Gods. Gaiman grew up in England and then moved to the American Midwest. At first, he thought it was the most prosaic, unmagical landscape in the world. And then he discovered a place called the House on the Rock.
Snow spun through their headlights and into the windshield as they drove through the darkness. Take Highway 14 west to Spring Green. We'll be meeting everyone at a place called the House on the Rock. You been there? No, said Shadow. But I've seen the signs. The signs for the House on the Rock were all around that part of the world, a bleak ambiguous signs all across Illinois and Minnesota and Wisconsin, signs alerting you to the existence of the House on the Rock. Shadow had seen the signs and wondered about them. Did the house balance perilously upon the rock? What was so interesting about the rock? About the house? Shadow was not in the habit of visiting roadside attractions. After almost an hour of driving through towns with names like Black Earth, they turned down a narrow driveway. "So what is this place?" asked Shadow, as they walked through the parking lot toward a low, unimpressive wooden building. "This is a roadside attraction," said Wednesday, "one of the finest, which means it is a place of power." "Come again?" "It's perfectly simple," said Wednesday. "In other countries over the years, people recognize the places of power. Sometimes it would be a natural formation. Sometimes it would just be a place that was somehow special. They knew that something important was happening there, that there was some focusing point, some channel, some window to the imminent. And so they build temples or cathedrals or erect stone circles or... well, you get the idea." "There are churches all across the states, though," said Shadow. "In every town, sometimes on every block. And about as significant in this context as dentists' offices. No, in the USA, people still get the call, or some of them, and they feel themselves being called to from the transcendent void, and they respond to it by building a model out of beer bottles of somewhere they've never visited. Or by erecting a giant bat house in some part of the country that bats have traditionally declined to visit. Roadside attractions. People feel themselves being pulled to places where, in other parts of the world, they'd recognize that part of themselves that is truly transcendent, and they buy a hot dog and walk around feeling satisfied on a level they cannot truly describe and profoundly dissatisfied on a level beneath that. You have some pretty whacked out theories," said Shadow.
That's Neil Gaiman, reading from American Gods, the novel that made The House on the Rock, if not a household name, then at least very familiar to Gaiman's fans. He read that excerpt actually at The House on the Rock, as part of a celebration of the 10th anniversary of the book's publication. Steve Paulson was there and pulled Gaiman away from his fans long enough to sit down in an outdoor garden. If you listen, you can hear the fountain.
I think one of the things that's so brilliant about The House on the Rock is that it creeps up on you gradually. The transition between somewhere that's kind of weird and I'm not even sure I'm on planet Earth anymore is this carousel. And you look at it and you realize there are no horses on it. Everything on it is like a child's fever dream nightmare. And it's the biggest in the world and it goes around forever and it doesn't stop and it doesn't slow, which of course... carousels do. They stop and they slow. And it baffled me when I first came to America. And I sort of thought, well, if I could only understand The House on the Rock, I would understand this entire country. I'd understand everything about America that baffles me. That may well have been the reason why I wrote American Gods and why in some ways I sort of kicked off the magic. The book starts getting really magical and strange once they've been to the House on the Rock.
Well, of course, what's so striking is you are, of course, an Englishman yourself, and in England is full of mythic elements. I mean, you can barely walk a mile without stumbling over some old stone there. But the image of much of America, especially the Midwest, is we don't really have that kind of history here. We don't have those sacred places, but here you found something sacred, apparently, at House on the Rock in Wisconsin.
I was trying to make sense for myself of the differences between the old world and the new. I was trying to understand why it was that, for example, when the Jack stories came to the Appalachians, we have these amazing collections of Jack stories from the Appalachians where they went and they collected the stories and they're unchanged as they came over from England 400 years earlier, except they have no magic in them. The Jack stories as told in England were filled with wizards and filled with giants and filled with shape-changing and magic and all of this stuff. And the ones told in the Appalachians are as if somebody's listened to the story and gone, well, that's a really good story, but that stuff about the giant, that don't exist. We'll take that out. And they sort of were the Jack stories. They're wonderful, they're tricky, they're intelligent, and they are completely devoid of magic. And I thought, I want to try and figure out a fictional context for talking about this.
So part of your project, it sounds like, was to find the magic, or maybe to create the magic, in America, in Wisconsin.
I love Wisconsin. I love America, and I love the middle bits of America, the goofy bits. And in some ways, it was, for me, this glorious excuse to drive around the state.
So that was kind of your research, wasn't it, for American Gods, was to do road trips?
My research was road trips where I didn't go on interstates. The idea was I would only go on old roads, and occasionally it was haunting. It was always educational. Sometimes it was very sad. Up in sort of the Northwoods, I'd find myself driving through little towns that had become ghost towns. And you'd be driving through something that felt like a lovely little town, and then you'd realize every store was closed and nobody was living in these houses. And the big sign on the marquee of the local movie theater said, congratulations, Bill and Edie, on your 85th wedding anniversary, 1991. And you're going, that's the last thing that anybody ever put up there. Nobody's here anymore. But all of that stuff wound up feeding into trying to write a book about this area of America and the madness of the winters and the magic of the place.
Hmm. Well, the other thing that's so striking about so many of your books, whether it's American Gods or Neverwhere or Coraline, is that there is another dimension of reality just beyond the wall, or just down the sewer grate or something like that. It's as if we're living in the surface reality and then there's something else beyond. Is that the way your mind works?
It's definitely the way my mind works. But having said that, it's also, you know, whenever I wind up sitting down and reading an article in New Scientist, which I have my subscription to, and I sit there and I read articles on New Scientist on the nature of reality, that seems to be what they're saying too. Reality is so incredibly fragile. Most of it's an iceberg and we don't understand it at all. Mm. And I'm very happy with that. I think a world in which we do understand everything would be an incredibly sad sort of place. You know, it's like when people say, well, is there magic? Do you believe in magic? What is magic? And I'm sort of saying, well, magic's a way of seeing the world. Magic's everywhere. You just have to look at things properly.
Now, do you have kind of a worked out metaphysical system of beliefs in your own mind? I mean, because you're playing with these ideas of magic and some sort of other reality. Is this, is it all make-believe or is it something more than that?
Oh, it's made up. But I hate the idea that make-believe or the imagination is dismissed as the sort of the bottom rung of the ladder. That's, for me, is absolutely the glory of fiction. I want to tell you a story, and I want you to believe things that aren't true. And I'm going to make up people who never existed, and if I do my job right, maybe I'll make you worry about them or fear for them, or be scared of them, or hate them, or shed tears for them when they die. My job is to tell lies. And not just any lies, because my job is to tell you lies that tell you true things. Hmm. A good story that takes you places has a magic all of its own, and a magic that's incredibly real. So dismissing things as just made up is something that I find sort of troubling and sad. When I was a kid, people would say to me, don't make stuff up. And teachers would say things like, you're making stuff up, aren't you? And then they'd say, you know what happens to little boys who make things up? And I didn't. And I had to wait and find out. And what actually happens if you make things up and you do it well is they give you all these lovely literary awards and you get a wonderful big house and international travel, and you get to sell lots of books and make people really, really happy. It's great.
Do you worry that our modern culture is losing its sense of magic?
No, I don't, because I think you find magic is everywhere, and wonder. It's not even the sense of magic. I think it's much more a sense of wonder, a sense of infinite potential. And for me, that taps absolutely and 100% into the imagination, which is the root of everything. Everything you see, any building, any microphone, any chair, somebody imagined it. before it could exist.
40 years ago, Alex Jordan began to build a house on a high jut of rock in a field he did not own, and even he could not have told you why. And people came to see him build it, the curious and the puzzled, and those who were neither, and those who could not honestly have told you why they came. So he did what any sensible American male of his generation would do. He began to charge them money. Nothing much, a nickel each perhaps, or a quarter, and he kept building and the people kept coming. So he took those quarters and nickels and made something even bigger and stranger. He built these warehouses on the land beneath the house and filled them with things for people to see, and then the people came to see them. Millions of people come here every year. Why? But Wednesday simply smiled, and they walked into the dimly lit, tree-lined streets of yesterday, along a covered walkway, in through another exit door, and they were in the carousel room. Calliope music played, a Strauss waltz, stirring and occasionally discordant. A sign proclaimed it was the largest in the world, said how much it weighed, how many thousand light bulbs to be found in the chandeliers that hung from it in Gothic profusion, and forbade anyone from climbing on it or from riding on the animals. And such animals! Shadow stared, impressed in spite of himself, at the hundreds of full-size creatures who circled on the platform of the carousel. Real creatures, imaginary creatures, and transformations of the two. Shadow inspected a bulldog and a mer creature and an elephant with a golden howdah, and he climbed onto the back of a creature with an eagle's head and the body of a tiger and held on tight. The rhythm of the Blue Danube waltz rippled and rang and sang in his head. The lights of a thousand chandeliers glinted and prismed, and for a heartbeat, Shadow was a child again, and all it took to make him happy was to ride the carousel. He stayed perfectly still, riding his eagle tiger at the center of everything, and the world revolved around him. Then the lights went out, and Shadow saw the gods.
Neil Gaiman, reading from American Gods. He spoke with Steve Paulson at the House on the Rock in Wisconsin. Making up magical stories is rarely a life-threatening sort of activity, unless you're Salman Rushdie. In 1989, the Ayatollah of Iran issued a fatwa, or death sentence, against Rushdie for writing The Satanic Verses, a novel of magical realism, inspired in part by the life of the Prophet Muhammad. Rushdie went into hiding for decades, but he didn't stop writing. He published 11 novels, which have won just about every literary award that exists. His newest is called Luca and the Fire of Life. It's a story about myth, magic, and video games. And he wrote it for his younger son, pretty much because his son insisted on it.
Yes, he more or less did. I mean, actually, when he was born, I already had a good suspicion that I would probably at some point myself want to write a companion volume to Harun and the Sea of Stories, which I'd written for his older brother. But then when he was about, I guess, 9.5, 10 years old maybe, he read Harun and was fond of it, but was very clear that it had been written for his older brother, and that created an injustice in the family, which it was important that I rectify. And he began to be more and more vehement on that subject, so I had no option really but to do what he said.
It seems to me clear that as you were writing this, you didn't have in mind only a 13-year-old boy or a 12
That's
or
right.
11. The story in this has to do with very adult issues, with the mysterious sleep of Luca's father. There is a word that starts DEA and is never finished, to my knowledge, in mm-hmm. the course of the story, but everybody knows what it is.
Well, I think especially if you're an older parent, I mean, like Rashid, the storyteller in the novel, I was already 50 years old when my younger son Milan was born. And if you have a child at that age, the subject of mortality is just much more acute. You know, and you think about it more. It's more vivid in your mind. I would think, you know, when I'm 20 years old, or when I'm 70 years old, this boy will only be 20, and how much of his life will I be able to see? And, you know, you ask yourself those questions as a parent, because obviously you want to be around. You want to be around to watch your children grow up into adulthood and to discharge your role as their parent. So, yes, I suppose the serious engine of this book is that. It's about life and death. Of course, it's the fire of life that is fading in Rashid, which Luca needs to go and find in the world of magic, to steal from the world of magic and bring back to revive, to replenish the fire inside his father, you know, literally to save his dad's life. Everyone in Kahani was fully aware that there was a world of magic existing in parallel with our own non-magic one. And from that reality came white magic, black magic, dreams, nightmares, stories, lies, dragons, fairies, blue-bearded genies, mechanical mind-reading birds, buried treasure, music, fiction, hope, fear, the gift of eternal life, the angel of death, the angel of love, interruptions, jokes, good ideas, rotten ideas, happy endings. In fact, almost everything of any interest at all.
This is also a place that you know a great deal about. This is more or less the same magic world that Harun entered, isn't it?
Well, it's related to it, yes. I mean, if we're going to be completely topographically exact about it, the Sea of Stories exists on Earth's invisible second moon, obviously. But in this book, the torrent of words actually gushes down from the Sea of Stories to the Earth. The torrent of words, by the way, thunders down from the Sea of Stories into the Lake of Wisdom, whose waters are illumined by the dawn of days and out of which flows the River of Time. The Lake of Wisdom, as is well known, stands in the shadow of the Mountain of Knowledge, at whose summit burns the fire of life. This important information regarding the layout and, in fact, the very existence of the magical world was kept hidden for thousands of years, guarded by mysterious, cloaked spoilsports who called themselves the Alim, or Learned One. I mean, I think it's one of the things you have to do. When you're creating an imaginary world, you do have to know how it looks. And I think the more precise you are about that, the more realistic and believable you can make that world feel. So yeah, I had a map of my imaginary world in my head.
But you also have a son who has grown up with video games, and there is that kind of world. What do you call them? At some point you say that they are like pocket universes.
Yes, miniature alternative realities that you could carry around in your pocket and then just plunge into. Once upon a time, we used to call those books. You know, now. But what I thought was helpful was the video game, or certain kind of video game, is structured very similarly to the quest narrative. The so-called levels of the video game correspond quite well to the stages of the hero on the quest, you know, even from Pilgrim's Progress onwards. You know, it's not often you can use the words Pilgrim's Progress and Super Mario in the same sentence. And then, of course, the quest story itself, the way in which quests work, whether it's for the Holy Grail or whether it's Beowulf defeating the monster Grendel and then the monster's mother and so on. There's a structure there, which is a very helpful shape.
But there is also a sense that reality needs to be just around the corner.
Yes.
There's another little reading, just a short one, that I wonder if you do, because it seems to me that it defines both the magical world and a little bit of its relation to reality.
Of course, Luca knew all about the world of magic. He had grown up hearing about it from his father every day, and he had believed in it. He had even drawn maps and painted pictures of it. The torrent of words flowing into the Lake of Wisdom, the Mountain of Knowledge, and the Fire of Life, all that stuff. But he hadn't believed in it in the way that he believed in dining tables, or streets, or stomach upsets. It hadn't been real in the way that love was real, or unhappiness, or fear. It was only real in the way that stories were real while you were reading them, or heat mirages before you got too close to them, or dreams while you were dreaming.
I think you might say that adults are much less innocent than they used to be. Is that one of the reasons why you want to write about magic for adults, to bring a little innocence back to life after 13?
Well, I think it's a mistake to believe that the real world is devoid of magic. For instance, one of the things that artists have always believed is that we get dulled by just habituation, by the dailiness of life. our senses get dulled. We cease to perceive the world as wonderful, whereas actually the world is filled with daily wonders, you know, and one of the things that art can do, I think, is to restore our sense of how wonderful the world in which we live really is. So that's one thing. And I mean, the other thing is, I think the world of the imagination has always been very closely related to what we might call the real world. Everything has to be imagined before it comes into being. You know, somebody has to imagine a radio transmitter before we can have this conversation. You have to imagine the wheel before you can make the wheel. You have to imagine the hyperlink before you can have the World Wide Web. So things constantly move across that border from the imagined world into the real.
Luca, at some point in the book, tells one of the ancient gods, and I think this is a quote, it's only through stories that you can get out into the real world and have some sort of power again.
Exactly. I mean, that's, of course, the sad fate of discarded gods. I mean, I have some fun with it in the book, that you have these deities who were once, you know, supreme deities, Zeus, Ra, all these people who the world lived in fear and trembling, you know, beneath their power. And then they suddenly get discarded, and now they end up in some kind of theme park or retirement home for ex-gods. It's a sad fate.
Can stories really make things possible? I mean, most of us live lives in which we pay mortgages, we pay car loans. You lived in hiding for a decade from death threats, and yet you've managed to hold on to this sense of enchantment, to this the glory of storytelling. That has to be hard sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, writing is hard. You know, I mean, I remember when my sister tried to write a cookbook and she kept complaining about how hard it was. And I said, well, yes, it is hard. Nobody said it wasn't, you know. But I think two things. First of all, that you're right, that there is a real world which is not like this enchanted world. And I think in Luca and the Fire of Life, Luca's mother, Soraya, is the one with her feet on the ground who keeps mentioning that. You know, she keeps saying that, you know, really it's more important to do your math homework than to be great at a video game. And that in the real world, as she says, there are no levels, there are only difficulties. And that, you know, no matter how good you are at the world of magic, at the world of imagination and play, you actually do have to face the difficulties of the real world. So I think that's true. But it's also true, I think, that we are creatures who live by stories. You know, human beings always have. And it's very close to the heart of our nature. As somebody says in the book, you know, man alone is the storytelling animal. Nobody else does it. And so, yes, you have to balance those two. But there's no doubt the real world exists. And that's, you know, in a way, the given of this book is that death really exists. You know, and this boy, Luca, realizes that his father, who only has one life, not the 1,001 lives that you can collect in a video game and spend with great profligacy, the person who matters most to him only has one life, and that life is ebbing away, and he has to try and save it. So again, there, you know, there's a deliberate attempt in the novel to contrast the world of the game in which life is cheap and plentiful and can be replenished with the real world in which life is dear and valuable and there's only one of it and it can't be replenished. So that contrast is very much at the heart of the book between the real and the fantastic.
Salman Rushdie, talking about his newest novel, written for adults and children. It's called Luca and the Fire of Life. What do you read when you need a dose of magic or enchantment in your life? Share your suggestions and check out what our staff is reading on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Mention fairy tales and most of us can name a few. Snow White or Cinderella or Little Red Riding Hood. Actually, those are all examples of very old stories. Stories that exist in many versions, in many cultures, all over the world. Why? That's just one of the mysterious things about fairy tales. Writer A.S. Byatt's been studying them, writing them, and writing stories about them for decades in her award-winning novel Possession, and most recently in the children's book. She told N. Strange Chimps that the magical stories we call fairy tales are some of the oldest and most powerful we have.
When the Brothers Grimm began to put together their collection of German fairy stories, they thought they were discovering the religion of the ancient Germanic people. But fairy stories are, in a sense, the opposite of religion. You don't believe them. You know you don't believe them. They're there in order not to be believed, and yet you need them. There are wonderful descriptions in, I can't remember his name, but a scholar who wrote a lot about Breton fairy mythology in Brittany, and he said we can no longer imagine the real dark in countries without lighting, where they saved the candles they had, and people would sit round the fire or they would sit in the dark, and outside it would be completely dark. And you kept your mind alive by telling each other stories. And the stories both frightened you a great deal and reassured you, always. They always do both. And that is what they all have in common.
What did you mean when you said that fairy tales to you as a child were more real than real life?
Well, I would sort of walk about and I would talk to the other kids in the playground, and it would all be slightly dreamlike, and I would wonder what it was, and then I would go home and I would get under the bed cover with a torch and I would start reading fairy tales, and I would come into being myself, really. I was sort of alive. I loved the forests and the trees and the creatures and the beasts and the sun and the moon and the stars and the sea. And all those things were more real than people saying, "Can you not stand up straight, dear?"
Well, the very old fairy tales, the kind that we're talking about and that you weave throughout this book, seem to me to grow out of a kind of almost an animist view of the world, in which the world itself is alive and enchanted.
I think that's true. I think they do. I think at any moment in a fairy story, any stone or any tree or any bit of water may take on a character, may become alive, may have a temporary moral purpose. Things in fairy stories are always appearing and being extremely useful. You know, I will give you a magic knife. It will show you where to go. And then in the next episode, it's completely disappeared because you don't need it anymore. Things provisionally speak. And I think I inhabit a world rather like that anyway, which probably comes from having read all the fairy stories when I was little.
One of the main characters in your new novel is a children's book author, a writer of fairy tales. This is the Edwardian period, right? The beginning of the 1900s?
That's right.
What are the sorts of fairy tales that your character Olive writes?
They are, I hope, I mean, they are her own. They're not like anybody else's work, and to that extent, they're my work. And she is a person who emanates from not only the working classes, but from the black mining pits in South Yorkshire, and has lost two members of her family in absolutely terrible accidents underground. And she's taken to writing fairy stories as a kind of way out of the intolerable nature of the life she was in. And she's writing this endless story called Tom Underground about a boy who loses his shadow and has to go on these journeys into the mines to find the Rat King who carried away his shadow.
She's writing that story for her own son. It has an unhappy effect on him.
Well, this is the problem I found with all the great children's story writers. I think none of them were really writing them for their son. They were all writing them for themselves. And the ones who were really happy ones were wanting to prolong their own really happy childhood, or in some cases to give themselves a really happy childhood that in many cases, when you read the biographies, they didn't have. The idea that Kenneth Graham was lovingly writing The Wind in the Willows for his only son, who was the sort of lucky boy to have received this wonderful fantasy story of these little animals in a wood living a kind of perfect pastoral life, It's simply not true. That boy went to school after school and beat up other children and was desperately unhappy and finally was talked into Oxford by his father and went and lay down on a railway line and let a train go over him. Hmm. And if there was only him, that wouldn't be interesting, but there are several other children of famous fairy story writers. And at a lower and more comical level, look at poor Christopher Robin.
That's what I was thinking of.
Well, he behaved with extraordinary dignity. I mean, he did not wish to be Christopher Robin. And he steadily said he was not Christopher Robin and made himself a business. I think he calls himself Christopher Milne. Mm. And he has explained it as best he could, that being saddled with this was not what he would have wished for a life.
Well, and then it was at exactly this period that J.M. Barrie wrote Peter Pan, the story about the boy who doesn't want to grow up. And, well, in fact, you set one scene of your book at the opening of that play. Must have been fun to imagine.
It was, and also, if you actually read the accounts of the real opening, the play was much different and in much more bad taste. And he had a scene in it when all the lost boys come back from Never Never Land to London. And it's a scene of the beautiful mothers. And all these women come on stage, and Wendy, the little girl, tests them on whether they are the mother of one or the other of the lost boys by whether they would know what to do. You know, I can't remember the examples, but if he had a bad cough or if he couldn't find his shoes, you know, and would you kiss him better? And some of the mothers are rejected and some are accepted. And the Victorian critics, the Edwardian critics, thank God, said, this is not a good scene. It was cancelled. And the other thing about, it's an uncanny play, that, because the other thing about Peter Pan is that the American impresario whose imagination made it possible went down in the Lusitania and he said to somebody, I think this is even possibly not apocryphal, he handed somebody else his seat in the lifeboat and stood there saying, to die will be an awfully big adventure.
I mean, just like Peter Pan?
Yes. I mean, I'm sure he was making a joke, and it's a jolly good joke to make at the moment of seeing you're about to drown because you've gallantly offered your place to somebody else. And he was obviously a wonderful man.
Yes, but it's so creepy when you then think that the backdrop of all of that is that all those young children who sat in the audience for the first Peter Pan would wind up dying in the trenches in World War I.
Absolutely. It is. And indeed, Barry adopted the children he had met, in fact, in Kensington Park. And when both their parents died, he adopted them. And the eldest of them died in the trenches. Hmm. And there are some terrible scenes in Barry's biography of him receiving the letter about the death of George and being simply unable to speak and never quite the same again. But that scene repeated itself and repeated itself and repeated itself all through Europe.
Hmm. Are you suggesting in part here that some of the adults in your story and at this particular period of time fetishized childhood and the world of the children's imagination and tried to linger in it themselves to avoid growing up?
Yes, I am suggesting that. And I think they did it in very different ways and all of them differently. And they knew it in a way because there were articles published in Edwardian papers saying children's literature is actually the great literature of our time. Many of the most important books in the literature we are now producing were written for children. And one of the reasons they would give is, under Queen Victoria, everybody was a gloomy grown-up in a black dress with a white collar and a cap on her head. And now we are free. And then if they were very clever, they would say the freedom we've got is the kind of freedom English gentlemen prolong by eating nursery food in English clubs and going and stomping around on the moors and in the woods in their plus fours.
They created what many think of as the first golden age of children's literature. Of course, more recently, people have suggested we're living through another golden age of children's literature. Do you think we're living through a somewhat similar period?
I think we may be. I read certain books that are sort of partly for children compulsively. But I think the phenomenon of adults who read more children's literature than ordinary literature is saying something either about those adults or about the adult literature of the society they may find themselves in. It may be that the adult literature is has too little story in it, or too little life in it, or is too pessimistic, which I often think, you know, most of the novels you pick up, most of the good, in brackets, novels you pick up are not very cheerful.
They all seem to be about dysfunctional characters from dysfunctional families to whom dreadful things happen.
Yes, I'm reading Fame at the moment on my Kindle, and it is not cheerful. I am going quietly along with it, and the Kindle says to me I've got to 65% of the way through. And so far, nothing of any kind of cheerfulness has happened to anybody, and everybody uses the word depressed about themselves every third or fourth page.
No wonder we prefer children's books.
No, I'm not saying I'm not admiring it. I am in some ways, but I think we need children's books because we need a way out. When we had writers like Sir Walter Scott, he wrote things like Rob Roy and Ivanhoe, and there was a lot of cutlass fighting, just like in Peter Pan, and people rushed across the moors. Or there were authors like Robert Louis Stevenson, who wrote Treasure Island and wrote Kidnapped. And it's hard to say whether those were written for adults or for children. They were tales written to be read and grip your imagination.
Well, you've made me want to get back to the library.
That's a good thing.
And Strange Champs talked with A.S. Byatt about her most recent novel, The Children's Room. And if this entire hour made you want to get back to the library, and you need help remembering which books we talked about, visit our website. You'll find complete book and music listings there. It's at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. You can listen to this hour online or find a link to the podcast on our website. And if you want a CD copy, you can order one from the radio store. You can reach them at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Uses of Enchantment, number 1219B. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Ann Strangechamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickert, with help from Aaron Kloon and Leanne Ziegler. We say a fond farewell this week to our longtime tape editor, Mary Lou Finnegan. For 17 years, she's made us all sound better than we really are. We'll miss her, and so will you. In the meantime, our technical director, Kirill Owen, makes radio magic every day, and our resident dragon slayer is our executive producer, Steve Paulson.
PRI, Public Radio International.